really, I think, take what might be the last week in this series that we've been walking through now for a number of months. I usually plan sermon series out a few months ahead of time, and I had something after Easter, and then the world imploded, and we found ourselves talking about this idea of a liminal space. We've been doing that really since Easter morning, and I'm sure this idea is going to keep around. I don't think it's going anywhere. It's in a way become a part of our vocabulary, but today we're going to take again what will kind of be the last look for a little while anyway at a story of liminality in the scriptures. And so if you want to, you can start heading to Acts chapter 8. That's where we will be. And let me also, while you're kind of turning there, say a couple of things. Just a reminder what Teresa already said, but maybe you missed it. Like, I'd invite you to take your phone out, open up the Church Center app, and sign up if you're coming on Wednesday this week to do chalk and ice cream. We need to know that count by the end of the day today. That would be a huge gift. The other thing I want to say is get ready to Google this morning. I'm going to need some help in about 7 or 8 minutes with your Google skills. And so just be prepared to do that. And I'm going to look for you to offer some input this morning as we look at this story from Acts chapter 8. And then the final thing before we read together, this is a story about hope here in Acts 8. And, you know, I think all of the stories that we've been looking at around liminal spaces, they all have the thread of hope woven in them. But for me, this one is somewhat front and center. And I wanted to end this conversation on liminality on hope, because we desperately need it. And I think that the scriptures show us, as we'll see today, that there is every reason for it, even when we find ourselves in spaces like this. All right, so Acts chapter 8. Oh, boy, if you want to read Acts chapter 7, you will find it to be both an inspiring and a terrible chapter. It's a chapter in which a follower of Jesus, a guy by the name of Stephen, is arrested by the religious leaders in Jerusalem. He is persecuted. And then he has this opportunity to give his testimony, we might say, to tell of his faith. And it's really quite a compelling summary of who Jesus is and what Jesus has come to do. But the religious leaders are so incensed by his testimony that they stone him. And Saul, who will later change his name to Paul, you might have heard of him, is there at that stoning overseeing it. And Paul, in fact, before he comes to follow Jesus, is perhaps the greatest persecutor of the church. And he's there at Stephen's stoning. And in Acts chapter 8, verse 1, this comes right on the heels of Stephen's death. All right? So a great wave of persecution began that day, the day that Stephen is killed, sweeping over the church in Jerusalem. And all the believers, except the apostles, were scattered through the regions of Judea and Samaria. Some devout men came and buried Stephen with great mourning. But Saul was going everywhere to destroy the church. He went from house to house, dragging out both men and women to throw them into prison. You know, what we are witnessing here, of course, is a crisis. Saul is actively seeking to destroy the church, this movement of people who profess Jesus as Lord and King. And he's dragging people out of their homes into prison, interrogating them, trying to get them to, no doubt, give up the names and the addresses of, if you will, of the people who are a part of this movement. And some people now are being killed, not just arrested, but their lives are being ended. And that's one of the things that strikes me about this is the way in which a crisis, like what we're reading about in Acts chapter 8, a crisis propels us into spaces that we would not otherwise go. For those early followers of Jesus, the spaces that they go are Judea and Samaria. They are scattered as a result of this persecution. And Samaria, as we'll come to see with the help of your Googling skills in a moment, is not a place where Jewish men and women would have otherwise gone on their own. And we'll learn more about why in a moment. So crisis propels us into spaces we would not otherwise go. This happens to us too. Think about what happens when someone unexpectedly loses their job. Not that they quit voluntarily, but they lose their job, downsizing, company goes under, whatever it might be. Who in that situation chooses to go on unemployment? Who willfully, on their own, without any other plan in place, decides to go into the space of unemployment and uncertainty and worry? I have yet to meet anyone who would do that. I've met people who, of course, left their jobs because they had another job lined up. But a crisis often propels us into spaces we would not otherwise go. Or think about a physical injury. Someone who has sustained a significant injury or diagnosis. That crisis propels them into a space they would, of course, never choose to go on their own. Or think about losing someone you love. A relationship that ends, or the death of someone you know. Who chooses those things? No one chooses to enter the spaces, the liminal spaces that those crises create. And yet, we find ourselves there when crisis comes. Crisis propels us into spaces we would not otherwise go. But here is what is remarkable. In that unexpected space, the impossible is often redefined. I think about a very, very small and really insignificant injury that I had to my knee about a year ago. Again, let me be very clear, in the scope of things, insignificant. But to me, you know, because it's to me, it feels significant, felt significant. I never would have asked for that injury, that this little mini crisis. I never would have sought it out. I never would have wanted it. I wouldn't want it for anyone else either. But all of a sudden, being in that space, being thrust into it, opened the door to possibilities that did not exist outside of that injury. And again, having to do it over again, I would not have chosen the injury. I wouldn't choose an injury for anyone else. I wouldn't choose crisis for anyone. But when we find ourselves in moments of crisis, there is, yes, both difficulty, but there's also possibility that just did not exist prior. Think about what's happening with all of this unrest and the protest and the anger around the racial inequality in our world right now. We are in a crisis. And it's hard. It's in fact, not just hard. It is life-ending for some. And so the difficulty cannot and should not be minimized, but there is also possibility in the midst of this crisis that just did not exist. People are having conversations now that they would not have had if the crisis had not come, had we not been propelled into this liminal space. And so hear me, please, this morning, not advocating for anyone to go and create crisis or to try and drum it up. We wouldn't wish crisis on anyone. But it does show up in our lives. And yes, there is difficulty in it, but there is also possibility. These two things coexist in liminal spaces. I don't know that we always can see this, though. I think often when we are in a liminal space, when crisis is upon us, often the only thing we can see is the difficulty. And that's understandable. Our world has been turned upside down. And so when I think about this story in Acts 8, I wonder, what did those early followers of Jesus see? Did they only see the difficulty? Yeah, maybe. The fear, the worry, are the religious authorities going to knock on my door? Are they going to drag me away to prison? Is my fate going to be like Stephen's fate? I mean, I imagine that had to be there. They had to have known and felt and lived the difficulty. But I think we also see them holding the possibility that existed in that moment. This is continuing on in chapter 8, continuing on in Acts chapter 8. But the believers who were scattered preached the good news about Jesus wherever they went. Philip, for example, went to the city of Samaria and told the people there about the Messiah. Crowds listened intently to Philip because they were eager to hear his message and see the miraculous signs he did. Many unclean spirits were cast out, screaming as they left their victims, and many who had been paralyzed or lame were healed. So there was great joy in that city. So let's talk about Philip and Samaria, the city of Samaria, for a moment. And here's where I need your Googling help. I would love for any and all of you to try and answer these questions. We're going to take a couple minutes here, and then as you think you might have an answer, would you just throw it in the chat window? And together, let's see if we can get a sense of why this was so significant. So one question you could try and track down is, where was the city of Samaria? You could track down what was the distance between Samaria and Jerusalem. That's where Philip was. Who lived there at this time? What was their relationship like with the Jews? How long had their relationship been like this? And don't worry if you think you've got it completely right or not. Just throw whatever you're kind of finding in the window and we'll sort it out together. And don't everybody just take that first question. I'm going to need some of you to take, like, you know, those bottom questions too. All right, so we got the Samaria is north of Jerusalem. That's correct. That's a good start. I think that might mean Mediterranean Sea. Okay, good. So this is helpful. 692 miles. Maybe there was a Samaria by that distance, Law family. Look quite a bit closer. You might have to, when I was kind of looking, I had to do, I think, City of Samaria, Time of Jesus, or something like that. It's actually within walking distance of Jerusalem. Who lived in Samaria? Oh, good. Mm-hmm. Both groups were from the 12 tribes. So that's getting at who lived there. Yep. Samaritans and Levites. And so Samaritans trace their lineage back to two of the 12 tribes of Israel. Okay. So Jacob has 12 sons. Those 12 sons become the 12 tribes of Israel. Yep. And two of them end up in part becoming the Samaritan people. Yeah, Zach and Kyle, that's right. About 35, 40 miles, you know, however you're going to measure it. That's good enough for now. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Samaritans and Jews hated each other going back to the time of Solomon. Really back to the time of the kingdom of Israel being split in two. That's right, Frenzy crew. In other words, by the time we are reading about this, we have hundreds of years of animosity. This didn't just happen a generation ago, you know, or a few months back. This is long, 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 long ago. It's a lot of history here, okay? Anybody else want to throw anything else? Those were good and helpful. So keep adding, because there's certainly more to add here if you wanted to. But let's try and summarize what we've got. We've got that there is hatred and animosity between Samaritans and Jews. Yes, even though they have a shared lineage. The real issue with Samaritans comes around the time of the exile. Remember? Israel and Judah, the two kingdoms that Israel splits into, are taken over at different times. But when, and then the people are sent into exile, but when they start to return to rebuild Jerusalem, some of the Jewish people, who later end up being called the Samaritans, actually never got exiled. So when we think of the exile, we sometimes think that all of the Jewish people got expelled out into other parts of the world. Not quite true. Some stayed, were able to stay, or fled, and were able to kind of make a new life. Well, these folks who stayed, again, who become Samaritans, do end up doing some intermarrying with non-Jewish people. And they set up a temple, a place to worship, not in Jerusalem. And it's these couple of things that become really problematic and the source of the animosity between the Samaritans and the Jewish people. We really should call the Samaritans Jews, I suppose you could argue that, but okay, we'll just keep them distinct. So that's right, Peter 7:22, that's BC. That's how long ago. The kingdom is overthrown. And so Samaria was this really important city. It gets overthrown along with the exile. Some people are able to stay, though. They intermarry. And when Jews who were in exile come back to Jerusalem, they're really angry because the Samaritans are often in opposition to them, and they've intermarried, and they have, again, they believe that the temple should be off in Samaria, not in Jerusalem. And so there's all of these reasons that to you and I might feel insignificant, but they're just not. There were things no more important in that day and time to those people in that part of the world. So again, there's hundreds of years of animosity, disagreement, hatred. It's significant. And this is where Philip goes. Crisis propels us and propels Philip into a space he would not otherwise have gone. Now, I suppose you could say, well, maybe he was going to get there eventually. Maybe. We don't know that. And if I'm trying to put myself in Philip's shoes, you know what I'm doing? I'm staying in Jerusalem. Because up until Acts chapter 7, things are going really quite well in Jerusalem. They're adding to their number every day. The Spirit's been poured out. Needs are being met. No one has a need in the community of faith that's forming this movement. They're worshiping together at the temple every day. They're meeting in each other's homes. I mean, there is so much good happening in Jerusalem. I'm Philip, why would you go anywhere else? Until a crisis comes and he has no choice. This is, I think, often the way it is for us as well. If we're comfortable, if we're in a place in our lives where things are going pretty well, most human beings are going to fight to keep the status quo when things are going well. And so not much changes when we're feeling comfortable, when we're getting what we want, when life is going largely according to plan. Not much changes, typically, because human beings like and fight for the status quo when we're comfortable or when we're in power. But crisis can turn all of that upside down, right? And it can put us in spaces, both literally for Philip, a place, again, where I just can't, it's hard for me to imagine him going outside of this crisis. Crisis propels us into spaces, both geographical, mental, spiritual, that we would not otherwise go. And in those unexpected spaces, the impossible is often redefined. So Philip goes to the Samaritans, does what I guess he can only think to do, and that's tell them about what has changed his life. And in telling them about the good news and in demonstrating the power of the kingdom of God, a city bursts with joy. The enemy becomes a brother and a sister. Walls come tumbling down. I mean, that is what's happening here in Acts chapter 8. Walls that had been erected for centuries are crumbling because Philip, propelled by a crisis, ends up in a space he probably would not otherwise have gone. And there he becomes open to the possible, what could happen, because God meets us even in moments of crisis and is at work in us even in moments of crisis. So the impossible gets redefined. The enemy becomes a brother and a sister. It's really remarkable. And it's a story of hope. And I want to finish this morning by telling you another story of hope. And it involves our story a little bit. So let me pull up here something that I hope might help tell that story just a little bit this morning. I want to talk about what's been happening in our midst in the last 3 months now, right? We've had crises, two of them, just because why not? A global pandemic and racism showing its ugly head. And what I've noticed among so many of you is that in the midst of those two crises, we've been propelled into a space that we would not otherwise have gone, and it has led to conversations we would not otherwise have had, soul searching we might not otherwise have done, and a longing for change that might not otherwise have existed. Again, let me say one more time, crises, as difficult and painful and hard as they are, and I would not wish them on anyone, but they do propel us into spaces that we otherwise would not go. And so I've been talking to all of you and listening with really a sense of wonder, as so many of you, whether it be because of the pandemic or because of the way in which racism is showing up, you are doing work and asking questions and having conversations that you might not otherwise have had. And all of that, my conversations with you, the stories that I'm hearing, it has all led to us collectively having this conversation in the last 2 months around liminal spaces. This is a sermon series we would not have done had not crisis propelled us into it. And out of this conversation that we've been having now, many things have come, but I'm going to highlight two of them here this morning. One is lament, and the other is a story or a series of stories about one family, one household at the branch. Let's do lament first. We've been practicing this together because crisis has been front and center. And as we've been trying to figure out how to respond, lament has consistently seemed important. But we've realized, of course, we're not very good at it. In America, in the United States, we're not particularly practiced at it. So we've been trying to practice it together through protests, petition, and praise. Judy Roy led us that one Sunday. We've been practicing it other weeks. And then reminding ourselves that ultimately the goal of lament is action. That because we protest and are honest with God and with ourselves, and we rely on God for what we need, and we ask for it in petition, and we praise God for God's past faithfulness and for God's present love and care in this moment, those things all propel us forward. Instead of getting stuck and mired in the crisis, we are propelled toward new action. So lament has been part of the outcome of this conversation on liminal spaces. And then again, the story of one household, Sarah Jane and Micah, who would never want to be held up as an example. Well, sorry, Sarah Jane and Micah, I think you're on the call today, but I am holding you up as an example because you are, as many at the branch are. But in response to this crisis, Sarah Jane and Micah and their children have done a few things. One is they started an anti-racist group. We've told you about it. Many of you are checking that out. And we've been on the call as a family, trying to learn together how to be an anti-racist. And what has been really remarkable is that on this call are people from all of these places and maybe a couple of others that I missed. But here's a clear picture of how crisis has propelled us into a space we might not otherwise have gone, interacting with people we might not otherwise have interacted, and a web of connection forming in a way that just would not have happened, I don't think, otherwise. So Sarah Jane and Micah are leading us in this, and it's a gift. And as we do that, as we do this work of how to be an anti-racist, we're learning that there's new possibility in who we can be in this world and the kind of justice that is actually possible to happen. So that's one thing they're doing. And the other thing that they're doing is inviting people. They invited in particular a woman by the name of Abby Reed. And some of you no doubt have met Abby, like in our breakout rooms, and Abby's on the call today. They invited Abby way back, I think Holy Week, somewhere around there, just prior to Easter. Sarah Jane said to Abby, hey, why don't you're welcome, you know, to join the branch on Sunday morning. And Abby took the courageous step of doing that. She's been with us really, I think, every Sunday morning since Easter. And Abby is an international sport chaplain. What a cool job, by the way. A little jealous, Abby, if I'm being honest with you. I mean, very cool. She's with Fellowship International Mission. She lives in Puebla, Mexico. Awesome job. She would say the same. The last few months, though, have been really hard, difficult, painful, because she wanted to leave Mexico to get back to the States when COVID really started to ramp up. Because, of course, as you might know, the medical care in the United States is better than it is in Mexico. The infrastructure, it's stronger. And so to weather the storm of a crisis like this, she tried to get back into the States, but she could not. She was not allowed to. That's a whole other story. So here she's been in Mexico. Many of her missionary colleagues have been able to leave. Again, it's a long story, and you can ask her about it. She'd be happy to tell it, I'm sure. So as a way of staying connected, one of the things she's done is she's been joining us. And she's been listening to us talk about lament and about this liminal space. And so what she's been doing is, as she meets with her athletes, who she's a chaplain to athletes, these athletes are spread throughout the world, okay? And as she meets with them over Zoom, she's telling them about what we have been learning and discussing together, about lament and about liminal space. And her athletes, who many of them are also stuck in their country that they're playing in, they're United States citizens, but they can't get back either. So they are quarantined in these other countries away from family and friends. While they're on these Zoom calls, Abby is sharing with them about liminal spaces and what they mean and what God could do through them and about lament and the importance of it. And so on one call in particular, the athletes who are on the call with her decide to write a collective lament about the racism and the death of African Americans that's taking place in the United States. And it just so happens that the athletes who are on this call, this particular call, are all African American themselves. And so they write this collective lament. It takes them a few days, each person submitting their own lament, then they piece it together and they write this really beautiful, honest lament. Well, this lament gets picked up by other Christian athletic organizations who start sharing it with their athletes and talking about how they can promote it as one way of responding to this crisis. And so these few little athletes on this call who write a collective lament end up impacting organizations, plural, who have massive reach really across the globe. And one of these athletes does something in particular. She's on the call that day with Abby. And she's part of writing the collective lament. This particular athlete, Bree Reed, though, also posts something on her Instagram account. Bree plays for a professional club in Denmark, in the Champions League over there. And she does something she's really never done before. She posts on Instagram and writes something about the way in which she has experienced racism as an African American, and how she's experienced it both in the United States and abroad. And it's just her being honest, really in many ways sharing a personal lament. Well, her teammates see this, and they are particularly moved because one of the stories that Bree shares is the way in which she experienced racism in Denmark on the team that she is currently playing for. And her teammates are blown away, they are surprised, and they're heartbroken. And they approach Bree, and after many conversations and apologies, her teammates say to Bree, at our next game, what we want to do is we want to kneel with you at the start of the game. Now, you may know of Colin Kaepernick kneeling, but And you may know of people in some of the protests kneeling, of course, as a response to George Floyd's murder because of the police officer kneeling on his neck. So her teammates say, we want to do this with you. And they do, as you can see in this picture. And this is Bree here, number 20. It is picked up by the leading newspaper in Denmark, who runs a front page story on the team doing this. No team has ever done this before in Denmark. They run this story, Bree is interviewed, and it becomes the most read story in their sports section that has ever been written before. An entire country kind of wakes up and pays attention to what's going on. All of this happens, all of this, because a number of people, very ordinary, wonderful people, are propelled into a space by a crisis, a space they would not probably otherwise have gone. And it leads them to have conversations and take steps that they might not otherwise have taken. And the ripple impact of those steps, the far-reaching waves of their conversations go out quite literally across the world. And all of it just kind of gets traced back to what we are doing here, this small little church here in Grand Rapids, Michigan, maybe 100 people or so, who are really, in many ways, if we're probably all honest, we would say not that spectacular. Trying to, though, wrestle and be honest about what we have been experiencing the last couple of months. And holding both the difficulty of it, lamenting that, and also holding the possibility of what God might do in us as individuals and through us collectively. You know, it's so easy to think that what you are doing in your little sphere might not have an impact. But I hope this story reminds you otherwise. Because you, being a part of this community, what that means is that the story I just told is actually your story. Oh, Chris, I didn't start an anti-racist group. Okay. Are you a part of this conversation that we're having? Are you talking with other people in your sphere of influence? I know so many of you are. Are you wrestling? Are you reading things you wouldn't have read before? Are you speaking up when you might have otherwise stayed silent? We so often underestimate what kind of an impact our simple, everyday obedience to the gospel has. And I want to tell this story again as a way of hopefully instilling hope in you and in me. I need it too. That what we do every day and the simple steps we take and the ways in which we follow the leading of God's Spirit, those conversations, those steps have ripples that reach potentially to the ends of the earth. You might never know it, actually. You might never be fully aware of the impact of your actions, but that does not negate them. And so here we are, yes, in a difficult time. It's probably going to be difficult for some time to come. And we need to acknowledge and be really honest with ourselves about that difficulty. And we are invited to be people who hold the possibility. What can happen? Because we find ourselves in this liminal space. So let me invite you here for a moment to pause and to just ask yourself, and if you want to also grab your communion stuff at this moment, you can scamper and do that. To ask yourself, where is there possibility in my life right now? Where, because of the crisis that I'm in, and by the way, many of us are experiencing crisis, not just in the two ways that we are commonly talking about today of racism and of a pandemic. People are losing their jobs. People are struggling with depression. People are experiencing brokenness in their relationships, right on and on. So I don't know exactly what crisis is most prominent for you, but where might there be possibility in this liminal space that you find yourself? And if you're not sure, that's okay, but could you be open? Could you hold an openness to that possibility? Could you be looking for it, mindful?